This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is the singer, songwriter, storyteller, and author Stuart Stotts, whose latest book is We Shall Overcome, A Song That Changed the World. It's aimed for school children, but it's a beautiful coffee table book for adults, too. Stuart Stotts, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. I am delighted to be here.
You dedicate this book to your dad, who died a couple years ago. And then in the afterword, you have a little story about him, too. Tell me a little bit about your dad and then how he intersected with We Shall Overcome.
You bet. My father was a Presbyterian minister. And he, when he was a chaplain, when he was young, I was maybe three or four, he was a chaplain at the University of Tulsa. And he had a background in civil rights, and he brought a civil rights leader there to speak. I don't know who it was, unfortunately, and they fired him for bringing a black man onto campus.
No kidding.
And then the story that I tell in the book, he about 3 or 4 years after that, he became a professor up at McCormick Seminary in Chicago. And shortly after he arrived, he was sent down south to support an intern who'd been working in the summer down there and was arrested for singing on the steps of the courthouse. As people, this is about 1963, and that was the kind of action that people did and got arrested. So he went down there, and the song that this intern was singing was We Shall Overcome. And when my father told me that story many, many years later, it deeply affected me. First of all, knowing his commitment, because he went down there and proceeded to, with the group that was there, to try to integrate a restaurant. So it was part of his lifelong commitment, but also that this particular song could evoke a response like being thrown in jail for singing on the steps of a court. I mean, it's ludicrous when you think about it now, and yet that's what was happening in those times.
And did that influence you to become a folk singer, or was that did he tell you that story after you'd become one?
Oh, he told me that much later. So I was well on the road. And my father was not a musician. He sort of, you'd watch him in church or something, and he wasn't really into singing the hymns. He was more of an academic and an intellectual. But he did have this deep and abiding commitment to civil rights, which certainly influenced me.
Yeah, you say he never lost sight of the peaceable city.
That's right.
Tell me about your interest in the song. I imagine it predates that story that he told you.
It certainly does. When I began singing, I came of age in kind of as an activist in the nuclear freeze movement. And there the songs were focused around peace. But We Shall Overcome was still a song that we would sing at rallies. And I wasn't much of a song leader at the time. But it was a song that was really my introduction to it as a vital piece of music, as opposed to just something that you might hear in the background on a documentary or something. And we sang it then, and over the years there were other occasions when it would become part of the event.
I'm speaking with Stuart Stotts, whose latest book is We Shall Overcome, A Song That Changed the World. I encountered Stuart Stotts early on when he was singing to children. I would bring my kids to watch him perform. One of the interesting things about this book is you go into the archaeology of We Shall Overcome and how the song came about. Give us a little sense of its history, because it has many parents.
Absolutely. One of the things about a song like this is you can't really pinpoint that archaeology. It's not as if you can say, well, Bob Dylan sat at this table on this night and wrote Mr. Tambourine Man. It's there are many, many strands that led to this particular song, some of which are the old gospel spiritual song, I'll Be All Right, which has kind of a similar structure and similar phrasing in places. Melodically, it's related to a song called No More Auction Block for Me, as well as there's even an old German hymn called O Sanctissima, which begins with that na-na-na-na, you know, the same kind of thing. And And there was a gospel hymn written by Charles Tindley around the 1900 or so called I Will Overcome. What's interesting is that the improvisational nature of African-American music throws all those pieces together like into a washing machine, and slowly something comes out of that which is blended into a song that we now recognize as having form and being copyrightable and so on.
One aspect of that heritage that I didn't know about was its early usage or a version of the songs in labor struggles.
Isn't that interesting? That's exactly right. Joe Glazer, who the self-styled labor's troubadour was the title of his autobiography, who sang for labor organizations for many, many years in this country, recorded this song. I don't remember exactly when. It must have been in the 50s, I think. And he was singing it for labor unions in the South, made up mostly of white people, people who would not have been friendly to its later integrationist uses.
You even trace some of it back to the early part of the 20th century, where you say there were mine workers on the picket line singing We Will Overcome, or then in a tobacco strike in 1946 where they were singing that same song. And I just did not know that labor history prior to it becoming We Shall Overcome.
That's right. If I can just take a moment, sort of the circle of how the song came is that it was a part of a strike and was sung at the Highlander Center, which is a critical place in the South for both labor work organizing and later on civil rights kind of organizing and workshops. It came there to Zilphia Horton, who was married to Miles Horton, one of the founders of the Highlander Center. She led it, and yet it was just one of the many songs, because at the Highlander Center, they knew the value of singing as part of political work.
And it sounds like she was the one who really knew that. I don't know if Miles Horton himself did.
It's a good question, actually. But they certainly made a point of having dances and sing-alongs. And there's a picture in the book of her teaching people songs. And she's got her accordion and stuff. And then so Pete Seeger heard it there. He taught it to Guy Carawan. Or no, he taught it to Frank Hamilton, actually. Frank Hamilton heard it. And Frank Hamilton added this kind of 12-8 feel to it. Guy Carawan then heard it, brought it back to Highlander years later by sheer coincidence, and continued singing it as the music director there. And then it got picked up by civil rights activists. And in 1960, at the founding convention of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the song just took off and spread across the country.
What is the significance of changing the word we will overcome to we shall overcome?
Well, now Pete Seeger says that he probably did that, although he's not sure, to get this sort of more open sound when you're singing, the ah sound versus the eh sound, which is more of a singer's syllable. But what I believe also about this song is that there is something about the formality of the language, we shall overcome, which takes us to great literature, things like the like the Bible, for example, the King James rather translation. Those kinds of things that evoke something higher in us when we use heightened language like that.
As in the Ten Commandments, you mean?
Exactly. I mean, just sort of whether not just in a religious sense, but it does pull something out of you to say, "We shall overcome."
Why this song as opposed to other songs? There are a lot of other songs circulating. What about the music of the song or the lyrics of the song that was so compelling and why it became so preeminent?
I think partly because it's a song of hope and courage. But I think there's also a mystery there. Joe Glazer himself said, nobody really knows. People just choose it. And it's part of the mystery of art. Why this particular song and not some other song like, you know, Oh Freedom Over Me or, you know, We Shall Not Be Moved. Why did this one? I think it's because it's a very expansive song. And it was carried so much by the tradition of people singing together. I think that not only is it about the words of the song, which are important, but the civil rights movement in particular was carried by people singing together and the way that fed their spirits. It wasn't just about these are words that are meaningful. It was about this experience is meaningful.
You quote several people in this book, We Shall Overcome, a song that changed the world. Stuart Stotts, by who said when, you know, they were confronted by the police during the civil rights crackdowns, and that they were scared that just the very singing of the song emboldened them. And then there was one funny quote you have from a cop who says, you know, if you got to sing, you have to sing that loud.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, my original idea for this, Matt, was to collect even more of those stories, kind of an oral history of times that people sang this song in the face of violence or threat. And because I think there are thousands of these stories where this song, and others as well, gave people hope in the face of threat, violence, whatever, as they were working towards something that they thought would make the world better. I think many, many people experienced this, what singing does when you're facing that.
And there is that catchiness to the song. You've got in this book a quote from Dr. King saying at the first time you heard it, that song sticks in your head, doesn't it, or something like that.
It's funny to me that was 1957 at this anniversary of the Highlander Center, Dr. King being driven back after being at this where Pete Seeger sang, and the song wasn't famous at all. And like you say, Dr. King sitting in the back and kind of going, the image that Pete Seeger told me is like him sort of humming to himself, like we do anytime we hear a song that's got to go to, yeah, that's got to, you know, it kind of sticks with you, doesn't it? I love that. And it really wasn't till 3 years later that it became well known. At that point, it was still just yet, you know, one more freedom song.
You mentioned Pete Seeger. There's a foreword by Pete Seeger in this book, We Shall Overcome, a song that changed the world, and a free CD of Pete Seeger singing it. What was it like to work with Pete Seeger?
It was one of the greatest parts about doing this book was I spent many hours talking with him on the phone, and he was always accessible and always helpful. He had a wonderful perspective because not only was he part of this circle that led to it being well known in 1960, but then he took the song around the world and when he recorded it, and then he left for a world tour. I think it was about 9 months with his family all over the world, and he ended up, say, 8 or 9 months at the end of the tour in Europe. The recording had made it there. He started singing the song, and audiences knew it. And he was blown away by this. You know, this little song from the United States, all of a sudden people were singing in England and Germany. And so the song not only is part of the civil rights movement, but has today, in some places, more meaning in other countries than in our own, I think.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, there's a picture in this book of a Russian protester who has We Shall Overcome written in Russian in his hat or helmet or wherever he is wearing.
That's right.
You have other citations from other struggles around the
That's
world.
That's right. Fairly recently in Kashmir, there was a translation. I haven't heard that particular version, but We Shall Overcome, we face the clouds and, you know, the darkness, but we shall overcome. So it was in India many years ago. It was a top 10 hit. There is a picture which I didn't find in time for this book, but I knew it was out there from the New York Times Magazine of a protester in Tiananmen Square wearing a shirt that says, "We shall overcome." So this phrase, this sentiment is echoed around the world.
And one of the things about the song that lends itself to other struggles is that it's so easy to improvise verses to make it more relevant to whatever struggle is going on.
That's right. That's the heart of this improvisational nature of things, too. And I think it comes out of the Black Church, from my understanding, that people in that sort of passion of singing and feeling would throw out a new phrase. Let's add this here. Let's add this here. And one of the other stories that was very moving to me in the beginning was at the Highlander Center, people singing as they're being raided by the sheriffs who ostensibly are looking for alcohol but are really just there to harass people. And them singing, "We Shall Overcome," the staff people sort of tucked away in a room in the darkness. And one of the teenagers who was there coming up with the phrase, "We are not afraid," which we now think of as, you know, one of the verses that we use. But that came out of that moment in the darkness, the sheriff's tearing up the house. We're going to sing, "We Are Not Afraid."
No, it wasn't used that much in the later years of the Vietnam War struggle. And I had the sense, or I have the sense, that there were some activists who thought it was kind of retro, that it was getting stale. And I wonder if some activists find it stale or a period piece today.
It's a really important question. Is it something that is part of, you know, our generation, should we say, that had meaning for those of us who were involved in struggles, that people who are 20 now involved in struggles don't really find that song meaningful anymore? I don't know. My sense is that if I had to guess, I'd say it's something that was really a part of that time. And I'm not sure that the tradition of singing together has translated well enough to the coming generation that they will stand together in the face of, you know, being tear gassed and sing "We Shall Overcome." I may be wrong about that. And part of the impetus for this book was, how do we transmit these stories and values to younger people about what it means to face oppression and to maintain a sense of spirit in the face of that?
So it's not so important for you that another generation or two from now is singing "We Shall Overcome," as it is important that people recognize that music and song and art can have this empowering influence, right?
I would deeply hope that people are singing. It doesn't have to be "We Shall Overcome." But I certainly hope that they see it as a tool, you know, that this will help us in our work. If we're only involved in political discourse. I was reading this Zen piece here where he talks about, if I can just read this because I love what he said, is the artists are on our side. I mean those poets and painters, singers and musicians, novelists and playwrights who speak to the world in a way that is impervious to assault because they wage the battle for justice in a sphere which is unreachable by the dullness of ordinary political discourse.
It is just a way to reach people. And I just want to cite that Howard Zinn. That's from a collection. We're still in mourning at the loss of Howard Zinn. And so what I did when he died was about 24 hours later, I went and read over every column he'd written for The Progressive over the last 12 years.
Yeah.
And I picked out the best insights, and we put it on three pages of our March issue, and we entitled it kind of disrespectfully distilled Zinn, but I think he might have enjoyed that. And but there is so much wisdom in those three pages, and that particular passage, Stuart Stotts, that you just read, is a real favorite of mine. I mean, Howard Zinn himself was a playwright. Howard Zinn's wife, Roz, was an artist. He loved going to the theater.
Right.
He loved music and performance, and he really understood that you could reach people so much more powerfully with a song or with a poem. Every time I saw him speak, he would end with a poem.
Yes, yes.
So he really understood that, and that was a real power he had. And that same spirit is coming through in this book, We Shall Overcome, a Song That Changed the World. I wonder if you think there is a contemporary song that has that kind of appeal for another generation.
When I go into schools, which is a large part of what I do, and I'll talk with kids, and first of all, is, how many of you know the song "We Shall Overcome"? And I'm sad to say that not many hands go up. They may have heard it as part of a documentary, like I said, but it's not really a song that's living for them. And then even with older folks, I'll ask, what song do you think has made a difference in changing the world? And one song that people often mention is the "We Are the World" song, a very different kind of experience. And yet, in some way, it embodied people's aspirations, too.
And it's just been redone after Haiti, too.
So. Right. So there is still that desire for that. I don't know that we have a song.
I'm wondering about Bob Marley, "Get Up, Stand Up." That's a popular one. I mean, he's more popular today than when he was alive.
I think that's true. That's true.
But I'm not sure.
Or people will look at that song that, what is it, Black Eyed Peas, the "Where Is the Love" song? You know, things like that. People like songs that have a message as well. They're moved by that sometimes. But again, the experience of singing them together is a whole different thing.
And I'm thinking, you know, a lot of people only hear "We Shall Overcome," you know, on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. You know, at a celebration, right. And people hold hands and sing it, and that's it. So maybe it's kind of lost its power. Julian Bond, however, says in this book that they're going to be when the moon is populated by little green somethings. Yes. I can't remember what he said. That they're going to be singing, "We Shall Overcome," up there.
Yeah, it does reach. You know, it certainly has reached beyond. I mean, how many songs reach that far beyond one culture into other very, very different kinds of cultures and still have meaning?
I didn't know that in the early part of the labor movement, John L. Lewis, the founder of the CIO, was such a big proponent, as Howard Zinn was, of the role of music. I mean, there's a line in this book that I hadn't read before, something like a singing union is a winning union, something like that.
Right. There's a wonderful picture that I found at the Library of Congress, which didn't go into the book, but it's a picture of these, they must have been, I think, steel workers. They're these big sort of burly guys in hard hats up on stage, and they have pieces of paper in front of them, and they're singing. They're singing as part of this meeting. Again, it was a time when people just singing was not so foreign to them. And the labor union knew that really, the labor movement rather, knew that really well as well. And then the civil rights movement, of course, really knew it better than anybody.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm talking with Stuart Stotz, folk singer and author of We Shall Overcome, a song that changed the world. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. This is a stunning book visually, too, which is part of our conversation about art and music. There are terrific illustrations by Terrence Cummings. Tell me a little bit more about him.
Well, I appreciate – Clarion is the publisher, and I so appreciate that they saw the artfulness of this subject and didn't want to present it as just kind of a nonfiction topic. And they hired Terrence to do illustrations at the beginning of each chapter, which capture some of the spirit of what's in there. Terrence lives in New Jersey, a great artist and illustrator, and it makes the book for me just sort of come alive as more than simply a documentary. I love his work. They kind of have the Harlem Renaissance kind of feel when I look at it. Those are the words that come to mind.
And what is the audience for this book? Who do you want to read this book?
I think it's an upper elementary and middle school book for the most part, although one of the beauties of nonfiction for children is that adults can learn what they need to know quickly. You don't necessarily need a 500-page book about the song We Shall Overcome, although someone could write one. For most of us, something like this tells us most of what we want to know.
And it's also, of course, a history of the civil rights movement. And there are real classic photographs from the civil rights movement here.
Well, it was a powerful time. And this, I think thinking about it through the lens of a song and the experience of singing is a different way than simply looking at it as, for example, a series of events or looking at the leaders who were part of that. They're all valid, of course, but this is another way of thinking about how that movement progressed and what kept it going.
It's an alternative of Crib Notes to Eye on the Prize, maybe one way of looking at it, with art and music to boot and classic photographs. Stuart Stotz, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Matt, thank you. It's been an honor to be here and talking with you.
The book, again, is We Shall Overcome, a song that changed the world. And we're going to go out now with Pete Seeger himself singing We Shall Overcome. And this CD, by the way, comes free inside this book when you purchase We Shall Overcome. Thanks again, Stuart.
Thank you.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, walk hand in hand walk hand in hand someday. Oh, deep in my heart, shall live in peace. We shall live in peace. We shall live in peace someday. Oh, deep in my heart, shall all be free. We shall all be free. We shall all be free someday. Oh, deep in my heart,
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.